Hey, how's it going? This is episode 8 in season 4 of Something Shifted. If you're new here, you've got a lot to catch up on. Something Shifted is about identity after interruption. It's where we tell stories about who we become after a life quake hits and what we tell ourselves when everything changes. And I think you're gonna like it here. My name is Sean. And this is Something Shifted. Today's story belongs to Kojo.
A month after I came out of hospital, my then best friend came and found me in my room, my spikes on my feet, in tears, trying to get my foot to move.
That's next, right after this. If you're one of those people that believe rest is a luxury, we can't be friends. Real change is exhausting, and even when your mind is ready, your body has kept the score and it can't keep up without proper recovery. So I've started taking Solol's magnesium glycinate. It helps with muscle energy, nervous system support, and I'm honestly feeling a lot less fatigued. You can learn more about Solol and their full range of supplements for healthy aging on Solol, solal.co.za. If you spend enough time with my family, you'll probably be invited to join us for a walk on one of the neighboring wine estates, not too far from where we live. And one of these estates has beautiful art installations across the property, a few of which are ginormous mosaics. You know, the kind that you can't really see the picture when you're too close, but when you start to step back far enough, you can see the entire image, which is when something clicks. And as you start to step closer again, you can see what it's actually made of. Thousands of fragments of different colors and textures, of different origins. None of them the picture on their own, but all of them necessary to make up the whole.
So how I always describe it is, I come from a very simple family. We're 5 kids from 3 different mothers of 3 different nationalities, all raised by my father.
When you zoom in and study the picture of Frank Kojo Bafo Jr.'s life, you'll see fragments from Ghana, Germany, Uganda, Lesotho, and Swaziland making up the foundation of his story. Kojo's father is Ghanaian, as was his first wife, and Kojo's older sister was born there too. His father later relocated to Germany for a lecturing position.
Where he met my mother, where I was born, and then moved to Uganda.
Their family had barely settled in Uganda when tragedy struck. Kojo was about 15 months old when he and members of his family were involved in a terrible car accident.
My mother, my grandmother, and my uncle passed away, and myself and my nanny survived.
Suddenly, Kojo's father found himself raising a toddler on his own. Some years later, they packed up their lives and relocated to Lesotho. And when Kojo was about 5 years old, his father remarried, and 2 sons and a daughter were added to the family.
Yeah. So my older sister's mother's from Ghana, my mother's German, and then my younger siblings, their mother's from Lesotho.
Like Kojo said, 5 kids, 3 different nationalities. A very simple family indeed. But as colorful as the various fragments are, it sometimes made it hard for Kojo to see how they fit together.
There's a part of me that's never felt like I belonged anywhere fully. And, you know, being my mother's only child, coming from a family, like I said, it's 3 different nationalities in my family. I'm the white sheep of the family. So, you know, I'm my mother's only child, and most of my siblings are West African dark, not just kind of black, but like West African black.
Fortunately, growing up in Lesotho in the 70s and 80s, race and Kojo's lighter complexion didn't carry the weight it might have elsewhere, like across the border in apartheid's South Africa.
A lot of organizations had set up in Lesotho to be able to a certain extent, I would say, sanction bust. From Lesotho, you could access South Africa quite easily. I mean, all the embassies were there. The high school I went to was multiple nationalities. From English to German, Swedish, Norwegian, American, Ugandan, Nigerian, as well as South African. So it was, I guess the cliche term is a melting pot, but our influences were global, although we're in this small landlocked country.
So even though Kodjo didn't look like his siblings, in Lesotho, that didn't matter.
Because, I was my father's son, I was so-and-so's older brother, I was so-and-so's younger brother, I was so-and-so's friend.
In spite of the tragic loss of his mother, Kodjo had a pretty charmed life growing up. In Lesotho, he grew up with friends from all over the world, and his father traveled extensively as a lecturer and later as a businessman. So Kodjo started collecting bits and pieces of the globe, even as a kid.
My t-shirt collection as a 10-year-old was amazing because I had t-shirts from kind of everywhere you could think about in the world. And my father used to send postcards, so I had a lot of postcards. My mother had a stamp collection, which I kind of inherited. My father also had a lot of books. I remember we moved from a university house to our own home, and he converted the garage into his study, which had all his books. There were good 2,000-3,000 books in there.
Collecting literature clearly rubbed off on Kodjo. As we record this conversation, the bookshelf behind him is fully stocked, ceiling to floor, and still growing.
I continue to have quite a big t-shirt collection. Yeah, I collect sneakers, I collect books. I've always collected music in its different forms. I remember being in high school and having this image of a cool guy with tattoos, dangling earrings, leather jackets, and riding a motorcycle. And yeah, I have acquired quite a few tattoos. I've worn earrings since I was 14. The influence of American television, right? I cringe a little bit now that I think about it, but the image of the Hell's Angel, tattoos, motorcycle, et cetera, et cetera. In the 80s, that was, I guess, my idea of what was cool, which has changed. I mean, I do ride a motorcycle. I started riding at 40 years old.
So the start of Kodjo's mosaic has all of these international flavors with a good dose of A-Team cool. All the influences handed to him by others. But the one thing that was his, the one piece that Kodjo was intentionally, deliberately adding to the picture himself, was running.
So I was a bit of a jock in high school. Yeah, I started getting into 100 meters at 14, 15 years old.
It was the 80s, and there weren't formal sports programs at Kodjo's school, or even in Lesotho, really. So during school sports days, the students kind of participated in all the track and field events, whether they were good at them or not.
I used to train myself, and I used to run barefoot on a clay and grass track. But the decathlete, Daley Thompson from the UK, and my English teacher used to have his videos, his training video. And I'd sit at home and watch the videos and train myself.
I have the utmost respect for anybody that's prepared to torture their body alone like this. As a swimmer myself, if there wasn't a coach on the side of the pool deck, I wasn't about to push myself hard. And there Kodjo was, going down to the track alone after school to practice running laps by himself.
And my friends used to joke, and they're like, Kodjo raced himself and lost.
The jokes were teenage jabs. They didn't land. And Kodjo kept his focus, which is why that twinkle in his eye grew that much brighter when a stadium was built close to home.
They built a new stadium in Maseru with a proper track. And the guys in the army who used to run, this is what they did. So during school holidays, I would go and train with them. So every day, Monday to Friday, they'd be at the track, and usually one of the sergeants would lead training. And I used to train with them.
A teenager, training with the army, because that's what focus looks like when it's real. After high school, Kodjo spent a year in Germany as a Rotary exchange student. And you best believe he packed his running shoes.
I joined a club my first week there, and we used to train, I think it was like 3-4 times a week. And but I had this old German coach, very red in the face. And I think he had even fought in the war, and he couldn't speak English. So one of the other kids used to translate for me until my German got better. So to give you an idea of what it's like on the start, he would make us stand on the line and then fall forward with our hands by our sides. And to stop falling in your face when you hit like 50 degrees or 45, you start pumping your feet. So your feet are pushing you forward, which means that your steps are closer together. In the start, it usually takes you like 10 meters, you know, between 10 and 15 meters to come up to your full body height. So what's happening is that your steps are closer together. And because you're pushing backwards, they're also a lot more intense. And then as you gradually kind of come up, like a plane kind of taking flight, as you start to come up, then your strides get longer. And that was, you know, that's, he always used to teach us to listen to that. It'd be in training, you're constantly listening to your steps. If, for example, your strides are getting longer too quickly, then you're losing the power of pushing you forward. Technically speaking, you're supposed to keep accelerating, but often, I mean, I would have it like at 60 meters or 70 meters, you've kind of reached your peak speed, and what you're trying to do is kind of maintain it.
Kojo was focused on maintaining his speed when he was racing. And like most of us in our 20s, he was focused on maintaining his dreams, maintaining the picture that he was building. The 1992 Olympic Games were held in Barcelona. I was 12 years old at the time and totally transfixed by the sporting spectacle, which represented a massive diplomatic and emotional turning point for South African sports. Being invited to compete in the Olympic Games as apartheid lost its grip on the country. The newly formed multiracial National Olympic Committee of South Africa competed at Olympic level for the first time in 32 years. There was this air of possibility in 1992, and it was the same year that Kojo relocated to Durban and enrolled at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and where he started pursuing his commerce degree, with his sights set on something much bigger.
I was playing basketball, I was going to gym, and I was at the track. So I was doing basketball, I was doing basketball practice twice a week with a match once a week. I was generally on the track 5 days a week, and I was in the gym 3 times a week. And my hope and my dream at the time was to qualify for the 96 Olympics.
To qualify and represent Lesotho at the Olympics, Kojo just needed to clock a specific qualifying time. And then he would be set. He had it all worked out.
You know, if I go in 96 and if I make it to the semifinals, then I can, you know, get on the circuit. And then the next Olympics, maybe I'm in the finals and maybe I win it.
Maybe I win it. Four little words capturing a heart's deepest desire. Fast forward 2 years. It was the winter of 1994. Kojo was warming up for one of those basketball games on a Saturday night. Just a warm-up. The kind of thing you do before the thing you're there to do.
We were a short team. So how we beat you was we literally ran you into the ground.
We already know Kojo loves to run, so that's not a problem. But during the warm-up, he got a pain in his leg. Pain was familiar to Kojo because he would often feel stiffness and a dull ache in his tibialis anterior muscle. Basically, the muscle opposite the calf, next to the shin. This is the muscle that pulls your foot up in the movement called dorsiflexion. So Kojo was used to this feeling in both his legs when he was running. But during this particular basketball game, that pain didn't go away.
It came and I didn't stop. So I kept on, you know, I kept on pushing through it. And by the time the game ended and we had to leave, I couldn't drive anymore. That's how intense the pain was in my leg.
Kojo was part of the team's administration, so he was in charge of driving the combi that night. But he couldn't. So the team dropped him off at his residence, and there he was, alone.
Literally, I was just lying in my room in pain. Like, you know, thing about pain is you can never remember what it feels like. But at some stage, I was banging my head on the wall to distract myself from the pain in my leg.
The following morning, a friend drove Kojo to King Edward Hospital, where he waited in the ER for hours.
And they did x-rays, and they said, yeah, it's probably a muscle strain, and gave me painkillers.
But by that evening, the pain was no better, so he called for the res doctor.
And then when the doctor came that evening, he gave me more painkillers and sleeping tablets.
By Monday, Kojo managed to get hold of some crutches and hobbled around campus as best he could. But by Tuesday, he knew something was wrong. He got himself to the campus clinic.
He saw me for like 10 minutes and he was like, move your foot. And I couldn't move my foot. He's like, wriggle your toes. And I couldn't wriggle my toes. And he immediately said, he phoned a specialist and he's like, okay, you need to go see the specialist. I later discovered orthopedic surgeon, and he's at, you know, he's at the hospital up the road.
This was long before personal cell phones. Kojo managed to wrangle a lift to the hospital with some of his friends and met with the orthopedic surgeon.
He was like, you need an operation. I can't fit you in. I'm going to refer you to another surgeon. So literally, I then phoned my father in Lesotho using the payphone, and I was like, okay, this is what's going on.
With his dad up to speed, Kojo got friends to drive him back to Res and grab what he needed. And then it was back to the hospital. Which brings us to the part of the story that Kojo remembers with perfect clarity, even 30 years later. His father was on the phone with the finance department. They needed a deposit before they could admit Kojo. It was 5 p.m., 1994, no internet banking, and his dad was in another country. The hospital didn't want to admit Kojo without payment, when all of a sudden, the back and forth and the pain became too much, and Kojo snapped.
The only time I've ever done it, I grabbed the phone from this woman and I cussed my father out on the phone and said, please sort this out. I never swore in front of my father. My father's my only parent from when I was one. I came with my father. I went to my father. So, I mean, we had our conflicts. We had our, you know, tensions. I got into trouble, but it's also a West African and African father. So even though, you know, the word shit was something that we all used, but I never saw in front of my father.
But that day, alone and in agony, desperate times called for curse words. And finally, Kojo was off to surgery.
Waking up, I guess, a couple of hours later in total darkness and going, where am I? I'm in hospital. What am I doing in hospital? Oh yeah, my leg. And then I look down and the blankets are over this huge mound where my leg was supposed to be. And I sat up and scrambled and I pulled this thing off and they put this metal frame over my leg and I saw my toes because it was bandaged up to my knee. But I saw my toes and I was like, okay, I still have a leg and lying back down and then the pain hitting. And somehow remembering that this little thing with a red button, they said, when you're in pain, press. Nurse coming and giving me morphine, which is an amazing drug, but not good for you.
Kojo remained suspended in that drugged haze for more than a week. Three surgeries in total. And through it all, Kojo kept asking the same question.
I kept asking, will I be able to run again? My surgeon was not definitive, although I later discovered that he knew that I wouldn't be able to run again. Because what they did is the first time I went into theater, they literally just cut me open. I'd been bleeding internally and it was starting to fill up from my throat. And so my blood, my muscle was gangrenous already. And so they literally just cut me open for the blood to leak out. And then when I went in the second time, they cut out the muscle, top and bottom. So they knew that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to run again. And I went back in the third time for them to stitch me up. And it was only after, I think, 5-6 days that he said, look, it's not going to happen.
And just like that, none of those Olympic dreams were going to happen. He was far from home and alone in the hospital with his loss.
I was in a ward with, I think it was like 4 beds or 6 beds. Eventually, the very nice finance lady put me in a private room, but I was under strict instruction not to touch the phone, anything else. So I was literally just in this room alone most of the time with a television. They come wake you up at 5 o'clock in the morning and then you're up. I'm having to get bathed. I couldn't get up to go to the bathroom and just, yeah, there by myself, kind of trying to figure all of this stuff out.
Eventually, Kojo was discharged and he needed to figure out what life was going to look like because the plan had been clear and decided from the start. Kojo was always going to go to university and then join the family business, but he had dreams of his own.
My father helped to design my degree for me to be able to be effective and useful when I came to work in the family business. I majored in economics, marketing, business administration.
But running was Kojo's dream.
Sprinting was the only thing where if I'd said, okay, I'm going to pursue this and this is what I'm going to do as a career, was the one thing where you'd have been like, okay, cool. I lost my plan A.
Kojo calls it plan A, running. But in reality, it was more than just a plan. It wasn't just the high of racing. Running was the rhythm of his life.
That one moment is great, but it's not just about that one moment. It's actually everything that you do around it. And, you know, you wake up today and you're not in the mood, but you need to train. You're at training and, you know, you're tired or something else is bothering you. But for that time, you are focused purely on the training. You're focused on the things that you must do. You do everything kind of for that moment. And it's not even in anticipation. When I stood at the top of the track, it was the one time I really felt in that particular moment. Like nothing else outside of that. You know, even the people next to me, it's feeling really in the moment, just looking down this lane and going, you know, not even thinking about what you're going to do and how you're going to run, but literally just being in the moment.
Kojo had lost the thing that gave him focus and joy.
I remember probably a month after I came out of hospital, my then best friend who stayed next door to me in res came and found me in my room, my spikes on my feet, in tears, trying to get my foot to move.
Kojo lost a lot of mobility. He needed to wear prosthetic support for 2 years after the operations because he now had what is called dropped foot. He could push his foot down, but he couldn't pull it back up again. So he couldn't drive, and he had to learn to walk again. And then there was the sound.
My foot slapped down.
And so the sound of loss followed him wherever he went.
Lifequake. I would say a moment in time that influenced the trajectory of one's life.
In his early 20s, Kojo's trajectory was rerouted.
I guess I lost something that gives me gave me joy in its own way.
After a few additional surgeries, Kojo regained some movement in his foot. He doesn't need his prosthetic support anymore.
You can see when I'm tired because I have a bit of a limp. And when I walk, like wearing shoes, walking like in a mall or someplace with tiles, I hear my step and it slaps down. I get bad leg days. I call them bad leg days. I get days when it's more pronounced. I get days where it's irritating and infuriating. And I mean, fortunately, I don't get them as much as I used to.
Although Kojo lost running, he kept the practice of mindfulness that he had been cultivating subconsciously on the track.
So I'd never made the association with mindfulness and running and being on the track, but it is something that I have done a lot of work on over the last 10 plus years. It's something that I'm very kind of conscious of and trying to live very much in the moment. And for me, that's like riding a motorcycle is another exercise in really being present and really being in the moment. I would say the biggest lesson gained from that life quake is more around how I deal with setbacks, how I deal with the difficult moments in life.
There is no way to escape hardship in life. Life is full of difficult moments, slightly off-color fragments that get folded into the mosaic of our lives.
And when I say moment, it's like it's a couple of years of trying to navigate it, you know, mentally, emotionally, physically, you know, make sense of life and how you define yourself and how you show up in the world.
Kojo wasn't part of the 1996 Olympic team, nor did he get to add Olympic medalist to his life's picture. But when you zoom out from that difficult moment and look at the bigger picture, you can see how much joy, success, and meaning was added in different ways. Kojo became a writer, a poet, an editor, a media consultant, a husband, and a father.
I mean, I've settled into myself. Look, I'm 53 years old, so at this stage, I've lost a lot of Fs. Actually, I've lost all my fucks, not even just a few.
And with the wisdom of surviving many life quakes in the first half of his life, Kojo holds it all lightly now, both hardships and happiness.
It's really not that deep, this life thing, because the first time something happens, it feels like the end of the world. Like it feels like it'll never get better after that moment. By the time you hit like the 15th, it's just like, okay, it feels like shit. Yeah. Like I really don't like it, but I'm still here and I got through all of those others. So the only thing to do is really just kind of focus on right now and keep plugging away. Like it'll be all right eventually. It will be some version of all right eventually. And from, like it's like the, I call it the 1 foot in front of the other approach. So sometimes when things are really, really tough, I try to put my head down and just keep putting 1 foot in front of the other. And when you look up, eventually when you look up, you realize, oh, wait, like I'm already halfway out the trough.
He may have lost one dream, but Kojo walked himself into a meaningful life, one step at a time.
You can never predict or forecast exactly what a moment is going to do for the trajectory of your life. So there's billions of potential paths that you can take with your life. And whether we know it or not, each little moment is influencing that. With a life quake, it's a bigger moment that you can kind of look back on and go, oh, okay, that was major. But most of them are, you know, small moments. But the moments that, I guess the moments that we learn from, or that hopefully we'll learn from, I'm waiting to see what the lessons are.
These days, Kojo is still adding pieces, living in Johannesburg with his wife and two children. His podcast and book, both titled Listen to Your Footsteps, are exactly what the name promises. A man still collecting, still listening, and still placing pieces into a picture that keeps revealing itself. If something shifted, has moved you, made you feel seen, or simply kept you company, the best way to say thank you is to leave us a 5-star rating on your listening platform. It takes 5 seconds and honestly means the world. Subscribe so you never miss a human-centered story, and check out the show notes for the Something Shifted soundtrack playlist a compilation of songs we've listened to while making this season. Songs that make us feel a little less lonely and a lot more empowered. Many thanks to Rue, my executive producer, for additional writing on this episode. And as always, thank you for listening. Bye.